Today, we're very pleased to have Sumi D from Syracuse University. Sumi's been doing a lot of important work lately on using gravitational waves to tell us what we can find out about the neutron star equation state. And today, she's going to be talking about modeling the confluent envelope in spiral phase and formation of LIGO's binary black holes. So just a word about the format. So I guess if you have questions during the talk, that are pressing, you can just chime in. But then at the end of the talk, you can raise your hand using the little hand icon, and I'll call on you to moderate that. So thank you very much, Sumi. Take it away.
Okay. So hi, everyone. I am Sumi D. I'm currently completing my PhD at Syracuse University. I would at first want to thank Will, who organized this talk, and I would also want to thank everyone for attending this. It's really unfortunate what all our conditions are right now everywhere, but I hope that all of you are actually safe and healthy. So in this talk, I am going to mainly, I am going to talk about modeling the common envelope in spiral phase. And so a common envelope phase is basically, it is a promising channel, which is actually thought to actually lead to the assembly of binary black holes and binary neutron stars that we've been observing recently. And I am mainly going to use a few of the results of my models in order to actually draw implications for all our properties of our black holes, like the masses of the black holes and the spins of our black holes that are which we are actually observing with the help of LIGO and Virgo. So as a start, here is a nice plot which is actually showing masses in the stellar graveyard. So the blue circles over here, they are the black holes which are observed with LIGO, and the purple circles then over here are the black holes which are observed with electromagnetic waves. And then the yellow dots over here are all of the neutron stars which are observed with electromagnetic waves. So an important question, one of the important questions in this era is that how do all these frequently observed binary black holes actually form in our universe? So in order to understand that, kind of let us see in a cartoon picture of the evolution of stars in our universe, which lead to these compact object formation. So how this takes place is that we have the stars in our universe, which have a main sequence phase, and then they evolve to a giant branch. And then at the end of their lives, they can leave behind a remnant. And so all these massive stars in our universe, which are not of very high mass, they can end up in a white dwarf formation. And then all the massive stars in our universe, they can actually evolve and go on to actually form a black hole or a neutron star at the end of their lives. But what we are actually learning now is that in our young clusters in our universe, most of our massive stars, they actually exist in pairs instead of existing as individual single stars. And so when these massive stars come in close vicinity to each other inside these massive star binary, which may be called a contact binary, then it's possible that they interact. And so recently people have observed these interacting contact binaries where the individual mass components can be as high as 20 solar masses. And so they are at the higher end of the mass regime of these expected contact binaries. So all these interactions are not rare or common. I mean, it is these interactions are not uncommon or it is not rare, but it's important to actually understand how these massive stars kind of evolve at the end of their lives, and at the end of their lives, what is it that they go on and form. So as an example, let's take a look at the close pair of compact objects, which is below at the bottom of my slide. So we have this close pair of compact objects, and let's assume that they are two black holes in a binary. And these two black holes would eventually emit gravitational waves and would eventually merge. But in order to understand how these close pair of compact objects actually form, the basic kind of ingredients which are needed to form this close pair of compact objects are two massive stars, which are at the top. So you can see that there is a problem here in that we have two massive stars, which are actually far, far apart from each other. So in order to form this close pair of compact objects, they need to actually be brought in close vicinity to each other. So as in, there needs to be kind of a transformation in the orbit of the binary in order for this to happen. And the way we think that this would happen is through the common envelope phase. So our qualitative picture is that we have two stars. One of the stars now evolves out of its main sequence phase into a giant branch, and then it impinges upon the orbit of its companion and engulfs it. And then this embedded object the smaller companion, it gets actually dragged into our stellar atmosphere into higher and higher densities. And then, so as this embedded object inspirals into the envelope, it interacts with the material in the envelope, and this interaction can actually bring about a modification in all the properties of this embedded object, and so it can accrete and increase its mass. Also, as it interacts with this gas inside this envelope, then there are all these drag forces inside this envelope that it encounters, and it is these drag forces which causes an orbital tightening, and it brings the embedded object in close vicinity to the core of this envelope. At the end of this inspiral phase, when our cores of the two stars are in close vicinity to each other, in order to actually obtain this close pair of compact objects, we would need to be able to get rid of this envelope. And a way that many people think that this could happen is that when the cores of the two stars, they come close together, then they are kind of violently whipping around gas, and this could impinge upon the gas and kind of drive it away. So, all this whipping around of gas happens, it kind of opens up a cavity, and that would enclose our core of the envelope and our embedded object. And so all these drag forces, which has brought about this orbital transformation, kind of disappear. The orbit stabilizes, the core of our primary star, it would undergo an explosion and eject the envelope. And so after this, we would be actually left with our close pair of compact objects, which would be our two black holes, which would go on and form our compact object sources for Virgo and LIGO. So in my project, my work had been to investigate this common envelope in spiral phase with the help of hydrodynamical simulations, and then actually study the effect of this phase on the properties of the of the on the properties of the black holes, which are being observed by which are being observed by LIGO and Virgo. So now, in order to understand the outcome of a common envelope phase by only looking at the in-spiral phase, we can ask a few questions. So one of the questions we can ask is that, what are the parameters which actually is controlling this in-spiral phase? And then we can also ask, or an important thing to understand is that, what are the actual gas dynamics which are actually bringing about this orbital transformation and making this process happen? And so specifically, we can ask how all this transfer of momentum, which actually brings about this orbital transformation, and the energy which ejects the envelope, how is this actually mediated in the gas? And so the way that all these interactions may be modeled is with numerical simulations. But over here also we would have many problems and challenges. And so one of our challenges is that in this kind of modeling, we have a huge spatial and a huge temporal scale which is involved. And so if we try to model the entire envelope in one common hydrodynamical simulation, then it's hard to actually resolve all the complex processes across the full radial extent of this huge envelope. And then we have added complexities by our fact that we have two stars which actually coexist. And so each of these stars would have its own parameters. And so it's possible for one to actually come up with a large number of combinations of all the parameters of our two stars. So in our project, we have tried to actually break down these problems and have tried to actually understand it in an easier way. And so in doing that, we actually zoom into the embedded object and the and a region around this embedded object, and try to understand how this object interacts with the inflowing material and gas around it, and actually what are the interacting forces that it actually feels when it interacts with all this material and gas. So in order to understand that, we start with our Hall-Littleton theory of accretion, which considers that this compact object is moving in a supersonic motion through the gas. And so if you imagine this red dot in our plot to our right as the embedded object, and so in our frame of this embedded compact object, it would see an incoming wind of this incoming material towards it. And then all this material would get attracted towards it because of its gravity and get focused behind it. And then a few of the material, it would get accreted, and the material which is actually energetically bound to the embedded object is the part of the incoming material which is accreted, and the amount of and all our material which is accreted is characterized by an interaction cross section with which the embedded object interacts, and this interaction and these interaction and this interacting cross section with our embedded object would be basically pi Ra square, where Ra is our accretion radius. So we can actually try to understand our incoming flow of gas in terms of some characteristic scales in our Hall-Littleton theory. And so one would be our impact factor for accretion, so which is our accretion radius over here. And so it is our accretion radius for an object moving in a supersonic motion. So if you kind of exchange the RA and so if you kind of exchange the RA and V squared in that equation for the accretion radius, you will see that it's basically the equation for the SK velocity. And so basically it kind of actually says that the amount our material, which is actually bound to the embedded object, is the one which is being accreted. And then we have our characteristic mass accretion rate, which is mainly a rate at which our matter is being actually accreted onto our embedded object. And then we have our characteristic momentum dissipation rate, which is basically our Hoyle-Littleton drag force. And then we have our characteristic energy dissipation rate, which is our Hoyle-Littleton drag force times the orbital velocity. So if we try to place this in our big picture of the envelope, so over here, the orange curve is basically the boundary of our envelope. The blue curve over here is the orbit of the embedded object inside the envelope. And we have this wind of material, which is actually coming in towards the embedded object. The A over here is the orbit size, and the red cross over here is the core of our envelope. So this incoming material, which is flowing towards the embedded object, it would have a profile which would be actually defined by a specific set of common envelope flow parameters. And our common envelope flow parameters are the ones that I have written down below. So they are our mass ratio, which is the ratio of the embedded object's mass to the mass which it actually encloses inside its in spiraling orbit. And then if we start from the equation of the Hoyle-Littleton gravitational focusing, then it can be showed that this mass ratio actually controls the ratio of the accretion radius and the orbit size. So it kind of actually provides a scale of the entire length of the envelope, which is being actually impacted by our embedded object. And then another flow parameter would be our upstream Mach number, which is basically the ratio of the orbital velocity and the speed of sound. And then we need to understand here that we are not in a homogeneous medium, but we are inside a star. And so inside a star, we would have high densities in the inner regions and low densities in the outer regions. And so this material, which is actually flowing towards the embedded object, this has actually crossed a huge variation in density. So in this case, it's important to understand and incorporate the upstream gradient of density, which is basically written as a fraction, or it is basically written as a ratio of the accretion radius to the density scale height. And so how many e-foldings of density has the incoming material actually crossed before it actually reaches the embedded object? And then we have our adiabatic constant of the gas equation of state, which actually defines how compressible our flow is. So another important thing that we need to, which we actually need to remember over here, that we have so we have a G over here, which is our envelope star's gravity, which actually drives the orbital motion of this object. But it is exactly the same gravity which actually fixes our structure of the envelope, and so it actually defines the gradient of the pressure and the speed of our sound in the envelope. And so we need to actually consider a hydrostatic equilibrium which is in play inside the envelope. And if we actually consider this hydrostatic equilibrium, it can be shown that all those input parameters in the incoming material, which I just talked about, all of them are kind of related. So the upstream gradient of density. It is actually related to the upstream Mach number, and it is also related to the mass ratio. And so this kind of actually tells us that we have a few relations which defines these kind of interactions. And so there are a specific kind of reduced set of parameters which actually relate all these parameters. And so we can move away from the infinite kind of set of parameters of the two individual stars when they are combined together. So if we kind of trying to understand how these relations and the parameters actually fit in the big picture inside the envelope, so the box over here, it is our computational domain. So it is basically a hydrodynamical setup which we call a common envelope wind tunnel. It is a 3D Cartesian computational domain, and we solve the equations of hydrodynamics and do the AMR calculations using the code called FLASH. And so our computational domain is actually kept big enough in order for us to encompass at least a full accretion radius, but it is actually kept small enough in order for us to actually examine the gas flows around the embedded object and not incorporate our core of our primary star. And so we use a computational domain length, which is equal to our orbit size. And so basically what we are actually doing here is that we don't ask what the full complete physics of the common envelope interaction is, but we kind of isolate our inflowing gas flow around the embedded object, and we study the interaction of the embedded object with our inflowing gas and the interacting forces that it's kind of really feeling. So, and then we have an incoming flow of wind, which is injected through our minus X boundary into our computational domain. And this wind of inflowing material, it would have a profile of the speed of sound and a profile of density, which is characteristic of a polytropic star. And so it is this minus Y boundary of our computational domain, which kind of enforces this hydrostatic equilibrium, which exists in between this incoming material and our primary star's gravity, which acts in our minus Y direction. And so, out of all these numerical experiments, what we are being able to measure are things like the coefficient of accretion and our coefficient of drag, which this embedded object feels as a response to the incoming conditions. And so basically what we can do is that we can repeat all these numerical experiments many, many times by varying these incoming conditions, and then kind of add up all these numerical experiments and try to actually come up with a way to actually model the entire common envelope interactions with the help of many numerical experiments instead of doing only one numerical experiment to actually model the entire interaction. So here is the movie of one of my common envelope wind tunnel experiments, which I did with a fixed set of incoming flow parameters. So you can see that we have this wind of material which is coming in from our minus X boundary, and this wind of material would have a gradient of pressure and density in the Y direction. As we go towards the positive Y direction, we are going towards the outer regions of the star. And then this wind of material is moving with a very high velocity past the embedded object, which is our white dot over here. And then as this incoming velocity, it exceeds the speed of sound, then it creates a large pressure difference, which gives rise to this bow shock over here. As the material, it crosses our bow shock, then it reduces in velocity and increases in pressure density and temperature. And then what we measure out of our numerical experiments are a time series of the coefficient of accretion and the coefficient of drag, which is basically the rate of accretion of the embedded object, which is actually normalized by the Hoyle-Littleton accretion rate. And then our coefficient of drag is our drag force, which is actually felt by the embedded object, but it is also normalized by our Hoyle-Littleton drag force. So how we actually go about this is that here I have a cartoon of our envelope, and then we pick a specific value of the mass ratio, which is possible for these common envelope interactions. And we pick a value of Mach number, which is actually picked from the whole range of Mach numbers, which are possible across a whole radial extent of, say, a red giant branch star. And so if we use these values, this actually places the embedded object in a specific region inside the envelope. And then using these values, we would perform a wind tunnel experiment in a specific region inside the envelope. And so then we kind of repeat this process with various values of Mach numbers, which spans across the whole radial extent of our envelope. And this is kind of representative of an embedded object orbiting into a particular stellar envelope. And then we kind of repeat this whole set of experiments for various values of our mass ratio. And this is kind of representative of various objects orbiting into various kind of common envelope episodes. And then we repeat this whole suite for two values of the gas adiabatic constant. And so specifically in our experiments, we have used a gamma equals 4/3 and a gamma equals 5/3. And this basically is actually representative of various mass regimes of our common envelope encounters. And that's because gamma equals 4/3 equation of state that would occur in envelopes, which is actually radiation pressure dominated. And so that would occur in larger inside larger mass envelopes. And then gamma equals 5/3 equation of state, that is characteristic of a more gas pressure dominated equation of state. And so it would occur in more lower mass envelopes, which would actually have masses, which is actually less than 8 solar masses, around 8 solar masses. And so here I have a snapshot from one of the wind tunnel experiments that I did, where our Mach number value is pretty low over here. And so this case is actually much close to an actual Hoyle-Littleton flow. And so you can see that and so we have all these incoming streamlines of these incoming material. So for every streamline in our minus y direction, we have a streamline in the plus y direction. So every fluid parcel would kind of have an equal and opposite fluid parcel. And then this momenta of these fluid parcels would actually cancel in our wake, which is behind the object, as our case over here is more close to a Hoyle-Littleton flow. But as we increase our Mach number values, we see that this momentum is not, a streamline momenta is not actually being canceled, but we see that we have all these high density material which is actually coming in and overpowering our low density material, and it is kind of actually turning around our bow shock into the regions of low density. And so we see that an asymmetry is introduced in our gas flow, and so this imparts an angular momentum to our flow. And then as we increase our Mach number even more, then our gradient of upstream density, it also increases even more. And so we then see that our picture changes even more. And so all this high density material is kind of moved around. It kind of receives a slingshot and it escapes the gravity of the accretor, and it moves to the regions of the outer regions of the star. And so if we move from our left to our right, we are actually moving from a high Mach number region to a lower Mach number region. So as a high Mach number region would occur in the outer regions of a star, and a low Mach number region would occur in the inner regions of a star. And so we can imagine this to be an embedded object orbiting from the outer region towards the inner regions of an envelope. And then if we take a look at how our gas flow would actually vary if we change our mass ratio. And so here I have two plots where I've changed my mass ratio, but all the other parameters are fixed. I can understand the characteristics of my flow over here if I take a look at this equation, which relates the ratio of this, which actually relates our mass ratio to our ratio of the accretion radius to the orbit size. And so as I had mentioned earlier, as the our mass ratio increases, in that case, the RA becomes a larger fraction of the orbit size. And so in that case, our incoming material, it would actually encompass a fewer times our accretion radius. And so it would get very poorly focused. And so as our mass ratio is increased, then our incoming gas flow is much poorly focused. And that is kind of evident in these plots. And then if we study the effect of the gas adiabatic index by actually keeping all the other parameters fixed, we see that our gamma equals 5/3 flow, it is not as compressible as the gamma equals 4/3 flow. Also in the gamma equals 5/3 case, we have high pressure gradients, which kind of exceed the accretor's gravity. And a combination of all of these factors, it kind of makes our structure of our shock kind of stand off as off. It kind of actually makes the structure of our shock kind of actually stand off from the embedded object more as compared to our gamma equals 4/3 case. And so we anticipate that as the flow is kind of scattered, we expect that this would cause a reduction in our rate of accretion and our force of drag, which our embedded object actually feels. And so here are the plots which actually show the outcomes of all our numerical experiments for our gamma equals 4/3 case. So it's basically showing the variation of the coefficient of accretion and the coefficient of drag with Mach number for various values of mass ratio. So each point in In this plot, it is actually representative of an individual common envelope wind tunnel experiment that I've performed. And so in order to understand all these patterns, I thought that it will be actually helpful if I recall how the pattern of our incoming gas flow actually it looked like when all of our parameters are being varied. And so I have added the snapshots from our wind tunnel experiments at the extremes or at the end points of our mass ratio and our Mach number parameter space. And so we see that as we increase our Mach number, then it introduces more asymmetry into our flow. And so this imparts an angular momentum to our flow. And this angular momentum, it would cause a reduction in the amount of accreted material. And so our coefficient of accretion would drop. But also as we increase our Mach number, it is analogous to increasing our upstream gradient of density. And so that means a lot of high density material is actually present inside our accretion radius, which kind of actually enhance our drag force. And so with our increasing Mach number, we see an increase in our drag force or coefficient of the drag. And then if you try to understand what happens with an increasing mass ratio, so if you recall, as we increase our mass ratio, then we get a more poorly focused flow. And so all this poorer focusing actually does is that the high density material, which is being brought into our accretion radius from deep inside our star, this high density material would not actually receive a large amount of it would not actually receive a large amount of momentum in order to escape the accretor's gravity and go towards the plus y regions as you had seen earlier, but it would accumulate around the embedded object instead. And so as a result of this poorer focusing in the higher mass ratio cases, it would actually cause an increase in our chance of our rate of accretion, and so it will increase our coefficient of accretion. And also as this material is not it's not receiving a slingshot and escaping the accretor's gravity, and so it's not as much impeding our embedded object, and so it causes a reduction in our drag force. And then we see that for our gamma equals 5/3 case, the overall pattern is almost the same, except that the magnitudes of the coefficient of the accretion and the coefficient of drag are much reduced as compared to the gamma equals 4/3 case. And that's because in case of our gamma equals 5/3 flow, it is a much less compressible flow, and we have a high value of the pressure gradients, which is higher than the accretor's gravity, which, as you saw, it causes our shock structure to actually stand farther apart from our embedded object. And so a combination of these factors, it would cause a reduction in our coefficient of the accretion and a reduction in the coefficient of drag. So if we now try to understand how all of this actually holds in to the entire picture of the interaction of a common envelope, we can pick an example of a black hole in spiraling into the envelope. And so the black holes, which have been observed by LIGO, they have masses as high as about 30 solar masses or even higher. So a question which can be asked is that, is there a point in the lives of these compact objects in which they actually gain a lot of high mass and hence it actually grows up to these high values? So a phase in the lives of these compact objects in which these objects come in a close vicinity to a lot of high density gas is this common envelope phase. So we can kind of say that the rate or the change of the orbital energy along the in spiral, it actually comes from our drag force, and that can be written as a coefficient times the Hoyle-Littleton value. And the change of the mass of our embedded object, that can be expressed as a coefficient times its Hoyle-Littleton value. And so along the orbital in spiral, our orbital energy, it kind of our orbital energy kind of decreases, and that is actually coupled to an increase in the mass of the embedded object. So if we kind of take a ratio of these two equations above and integrate it by assuming that our coefficients of accretion and drag and our mass ratio kind of remains close to the typical values over the course of the in spiral, and then it would allow us to actually come up with an expression which is the ratio of the end mass to the initial mass of the embedded object, which can be expressed in terms of our change in the orbital energy, the coefficients of the accretion and drag, and our mass ratio. And then if the accreted material, it has angular momentum, then it can also spin up the black hole. So if the accreted material, it includes the specific angular momentum of the it includes the specific angular momentum of the last stable circular orbit of the black hole, then it can end up with a spin, which can be expressed in terms of a ratio of the accrued mass to the initial mass of the emitted object. So in case of a Hoyle-Littleton flow, our coefficient of accretion and drag is equal to 1, and it can be shown that the accrued mass in this case is basically a reduced mass of our pair of objects. And so it can be actually shown that an embedded object which is a black hole, it can actually accrete of the order of its own mass if we actually consider a homogeneous Hoyle-Littleton flow. And so it means that that after a common envelope in spiral phase, a black hole would actually grow up to 2 times its initial value. And so this means that if we actually start with a 10 solar mass black hole, in that case, we would end up with a 20 solar mass black hole, which might be possible, but it also means that if we start with a 1.4 solar mass neutron star, then we would end up with around a 2.8 solar mass neutron star. But we know that all these neutron stars of masses 1.35 solar masses can exist in binaries. And so it kind of indicates that our common envelope phase cannot actually add a lot of mass onto all these compact objects. Otherwise, we would have a problem here. And so if a high amount of mass is also accreted into our black holes, then it would also mean that it would spin up our black holes a lot. And so it would mean that if a black hole grows all our So it means that all our black holes, which actually pass through a common envelope phase, at the end of the phase, if it grows up to two times its initial up to two times its initial value, then it would mean that all our black holes which are being observed in LIGO, it would have a spin close to one. But that's not a case that we actually see based on our observations. And so we can also actually check this by incorporating our astrophysical realistic coefficients, which is obtained from our hydrodynamical simulations, into our calculations of the accurate mass and the accurate spin. So here is a plot where all the output coefficients of accretion and drag from all our experiments of the gamma equals 4/3 case are actually compressed onto one plot, and it shows the variation of the ratio of the coefficient of accretion to the coefficient of drag with a changing mass ratio and a changing Mach number. But a problem over here is that our coefficient of accretion and drag that we actually measure out of our experiments is it is not actually truly representative of an astrophysical case where the embedded object is a black hole. And the reason over here is that the accreting object, which we use as a sink, it has a radius, and that radius is actually set to be 0.05 times the accretion radius. And so although it seems to be small, it is not actually small enough for a black hole. Also, in our experiments, it's not possible to actually reduce it's not actually possible to reduce our accreting sink size even more. It's very hard to actually resolve both our embedded object and the whole length of the entire range of our accretion radius inside a common inside a common hydrodynamical experiment. Our embedded object size is very small and the accretion radius is very large. And so it's not actually possible at the same time actually resolve both our accreting object size and the accretion radius. And so how we actually get around this is that we repeat all our experiments with various values of the with various values of the accreting sink size, and so in each time we actually reduce the value of the accreting of the accreting sink size to half of its initial value, and we do this three times, and then we use the outcomes of all these numerical experiments and extrapolate it to a much smaller sink size in which the accreting sink size would be around 10 to the power of minus 5 times the accretion radius. And this case is more representative of an astrophysical case where the embedded object is a black hole. So then we then use all these possible mass ratios and these projected coefficients, and then combine it with the rate of change of possible orbital energies over a common envelope episode. And we actually apply all these values to our equations, which would provide the amount of mass and the spins which is accumulated by a black hole in the spiral phase. And that gives us and that tells us that the amount of mass which is accumulated by a black hole in spiraling into a red giant envelope, it would accumulate up to about at most 0.01 to 0.02 solar masses, and it would accrue spin of at most about 0.05. And so these values are not very high. And so this tells us that based on our astrophysical reality coefficients obtained from our hydrodynamical simulations, the black holes are expected to gain only a very few percent of their initial mass and their initial spin. And so that brings me to the conclusions. So we had performed local simulations of the common envelope in spiral phase of the black holes, which are in spiraling inside the giant star envelopes by using a systematic survey of parameters which characterizes the incoming gas flows. And then a crucial phenomena inside all these interactions is that the amount of mass which is being accreted by the embedded object, that is actually coupled to the amount of the orbital tightening. And all these individual quantities are actually dependent on the coefficient of the accretion and drag. And so it is important to incorporate accurately our coefficients of accretion and drag when we are actually calculating the amount of mass and the spin which are being accrued by our black holes. And so on using our outcomes of our hydrodynamical simulations, we have predicted that all these typical black holes, it would accumulate only a very few percent level mass and spin over a course of a common envelope in spiral phase. And so that indicates that any birth mass distribution of black holes, any characteristic birth mass distribution of black holes or any characteristic spins of black holes, it would remain unmodified by a common envelope phase. And so I think that by addressing questions like this, it would actually help in understanding, and it would actually add value in understanding all in understanding all the properties of the black holes which are being observed by LIGO, and in understanding how these compact object sources actually assemble. And so that brings me to the end of my my talk. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Sumi.
Okay,
so I guess we can take some questions now. I see several hands. I think Louise, you were first.
Okay, I can go on, but actually I was using what Neil said yesterday. If you click on the hand, it's a sign of clapping. So I was clapping, but I do have a question. So Sumi, thanks for your talk. Just have a question. So given the simplifications that you, well, one has to do in order to keep track on all the physics or a good chunk of the physics that is going on in the process, and the results that you mentioned that the parameters you choose critically determine what the predictions would be, how much do you think the physics that has not been put in could change the results? And so how does one go about trying to assess how the robustness of the conclusions one has?
You're right. So it's a very good question. So at the moment, so what we like see is that if we include more and more physics, then it kind of it gets more harder to actually resolve all of our complex processes and all of the morphologies of our our gas flows, which are actually pay. So at this moment, the best that we could do at this stage is to is actually what we have done right now is to like kind of actually find all these interrelations in between these parameters, and then there'll be other physics which we which could not have been incorporated into these easy experiments, like things like the recombination energy, etc., which have been incorporated in all these hydro simulations, which actually model the entire envelope instead of seeing what is actually happening locally. But if we actually see the main results of our paper over here, then our aim was to actually see how much kind of like make a guess of the extent of the mass or the extent of the spin which a typical black hole can actually accumulate in a course of an in spiral of our common envelope phase. So I think that if we even like make our experiments more complicated and include more physics, then as we have found right now, our accrued mass, it goes to at most like 1% of the initial mass. So if we include more physics, maybe it will change to like 2% or 3% or also go on the other side, and so like lower than 1%. But that would not like meaningfully like change the overall qualitative result that a common envelope phase, it actually does not add on to a lot of mass or add on to a lot of the initial spin of the existing or a birth mass spin or a birth mass or a starting birth mass of a black hole population. And so I think that if we add like the even more physics, then it can like change our end result from like 1% to maybe like 2% or 3%. It might or might not, but if it overall changes, like our main message is like the overall picture which we are showing is our common envelope interactions not modifying the initial distribution or the initial characteristic distribution of these black holes by much. So I think like this end message could not change much. But I think that it would be also interesting to see how these kind of quoted numbers, how much or to what extent these numbers can actually change if we include more and more physics into our experiments. Is that answering your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
So I think there are actually two separate icons for raising hand and clapping if you go to your more button. Daniel, you're next.
It's with me, this is Daniel. Thanks for the nice talk. I have actually two questions. So the first one is, if you can go back to this extrapolation that you mentioned, trying to assess essentially the robustness of the drag and accretion coefficient as a function of the sort of accretion, sort of this inner black hole radius. So can you remind me again, so how far out from the black hole horizon are you here? Like where you put your essentially accretion boundary?
So in this case, like we had considered a mass ratio of 1/6 So I mean, it can be actually mapped out, for example, to a mass ratio of 1/6. And so maybe our ratio of masses in between the embedded black hole and the envelope is 1/6, and the embedded object is at a distance of maybe like 10 solar radius from the core of our envelope, then that would actually correspond to a size of our our sink, which is more appropriate for our astrophysical case, which is our 10 to the power of 5, our 10 to the power of minus 5 times our accretion radius. So it actually corresponds to a mass ratio of 1/6 and the embedded object placed at a 10 solar radius away from the core of the envelope.
Right. Okay. Because one question I had is because in principle there is no source of cooling here, right? So you have fairly hot gas, and so you're forced to accrete that hot gas onto the black hole. But if in absence of cooling, there might actually be if you resolve closer and closer to the black hole, at some point the gas should be so hot that essentially the thermal pressure would sort of resist accretion. So you could have sort of an additional effect that actually your accretion coefficient could even be less than essentially estimated. So which would sort of play in the direction of your argument of sort of only sort of very small accreted mass on the percent level. I was just wondering essentially if sort of that the fact that you have very hot gas and your sink radius is still like fairly large, could actually sort of overestimate the amount of accreted mass onto the black hole.
Mm-hmm. So what we had actually measured from our numerical experiments what's actually possible to be measured from our numerical experiments is an overestimate of the actual real astrophysical value. So like, which is why we had to like extrapolate to these lower values of the radius of our sink, mm-hmm. in order to do that.
Okay, thanks. And so the second question real quick that I had is, can you say something about the, is there anything essentially you can say from these simulations about the actually ejection mechanism of the common envelope? Because that's like still a big mystery of how do you actually get rid of the envelope eventually during this common envelope process. But I was wondering from your simulations if, you know, you can essentially roughly estimate some sort of shock heating in your wind tunnel simulation. Is there anything you can sort of say in terms of how much energy you would gain and how that could potentially contribute to sort of ejecting the envelope?
The short answer is like no, because like it actually kind of like looks at the local kind of flow and is not actually evolving the entire envelope as a whole. I don't think like we have as we are actually looking at a very like different phase of our common envelope evolution. So it's like much before the ejection of the envelope, as you also said. And so like based on like all the values that we have measured from our experiments, I don't think we have anything which would actually hint at the mechanism by which our envelope will be ejected.
Okay, thanks.
Juan, you had a question?
Okay, thank you, Sumi. So I have one question regarding the spin change. So if you put a black hole in your accretion disk, the accretion disk rotates, right? Like, and if the black hole spin is misaligned with the rotation axis with the disk, then the black hole will gradually, the spin will gradually be pulled towards the rotation direction of the disk by this so-called Bardeen-Peterson mechanism. So it is basically by you can either think of it as a Lanserian effect or the spin orbit coupling. So basically, in this mechanism, you don't even need accretion. It's just the spin orbit interaction, and that will change the spin directions. So now you estimate your spin change based on how many matter is accreted. So I wonder why. I mean, that may not be the dominant effect to change the spin, at least for the direction. So if you have a misaligned disk, accretion disk, like which may also happen here, around the black hole, that will also change the black hole spin in your case. So I wonder, what do you think about this?
So like what we actually observed in our experiments is that we don't observe an accretion disk formation. So we had actually seen that if we reduce our adiabatic constant to a much, much lower values as compared to what we have used, only then our gas would get more and more compressible, and only in that case we would actually form an accretion disk. So in our experiments that we have done, we have not observed an accretion disk formation, and so the effect that you have just actually mentioned about the effect of the accretion disk actually contributing to the spins of the black hole. So I don't think that can be incorporated over here, as we don't actually observe an accretion disk formation in our case.
Right. Do you have rotation in your profile for your gas? I mean, if the gas, right, if your star or your gas profile has rotation, as it accretes onto the black hole, I mean, the rotation itself carries angular momentum, so it cannot just directly plunge into a black hole. It has to form something like a disk or, I don't know, a bulge or something. It doesn't, I mean, it has to dissipate this angular momentum before it goes into the black hole. Do you have this rotation in your simulation, in your simulation? Is your gas profile rotating?
We see a higher amount of rotation as, in case of the gamma equals 4/3 case as compared to the gamma equals 5/3 case, as our gas is more compressible and it is kind of like rotating around.
The global profile of the gas, is it rotating?
Our profile of our gas, it is it is actually synchronized to our orbital velocity. And so like we are actually considering that our envelope is not rotating. It is not rotating like relative to our orbital motion.
Yeah. So I think if you have rotation with respect to the black hole, then you will have something like a disk or something, a bulge or something.
But in our experiments, like we had actually considered a envelope which is actually not rotating. So I don't think like we'll be able to incorporate what you are saying, but it would be actually interesting to see how all these outcomes would change if we actually consider a rotating envelope, as you just mentioned.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
Shinyu, you had a question?
I have a question about the simulations. right? So your excuse me. So your box size only extends to RA. So I'm wondering how would your results depend on this box size? For example, your CD will definitely change a lot, because the dynamical friction tends to diverge as you increase your box size, right? The matter, which is kind of in the overdense wake behind the central compact object, the thing that is on the large scale will also contribute to the dynamical friction that will increase the drag that you can infer from your simulation. But how much this simulation gonna change the hydrodynamics in there? Have you ever explored that or not?
So I can try to answer this question in the way that so our box size, it actually is, it actually scales. It actually scales with our mass ratio. We see that our box size is always equal to the accretion radius. So basically, you are saying that if we had actually incorporated like 2 RA or maybe like more instead of RA, so how would like that affect? Are you saying that?
Yeah, I'm thinking like definitely the dynamical friction will change the value you get from that. But since writing, if you see your simulations, the velocity, the velocity streamline on the boundaries will change a lot, right? So I'm wondering, right, if you just enlarge your box, so whatever the incoming gas from even larger region, how would that change affect the dynamics of the gas?
Yeah, so like we had not explored that, but I think that the reason why we chose a box size equal to RA is that we would actually want to actually study as our main goal and the main principle behind our numerical experiments is that we are studying the flows around the embedded object. So if we increase our box size like more and more, then in case of specific values of our mass ratio, then if we increase from like RA to maybe like 2 RA, then it will start incorporating our core of our primary star instead of eliminating it. So it would like not have been applicable for all our values of our mass ratio. So it would be like interesting to like probably see what happens if we increase from RA to 1.5 RA, but I don't think we can go from RA from RA to like 2 RA, as like that would actually violate the main assumptions of our numerical experiments. And I don't know if we increase from RA to 1.5 RA, if like that is going to affect a lot as compared to what we have right now.
Okay, thank you.
Drew, if you had a question.
Yeah, hi, nice talk. Sorry, I just wanted to clarify, I probably just missed this, but you were saying that the star isn't rotating.
It is in rotating.
But so then you have the black hole, which is inside the star, but that's obviously orbiting like relative to the star, right?
Yes.
So I was just confused because isn't all you care about like the rotation of the star relative to the black hole? So, okay, if the star is rotating at some velocity, then wouldn't all you care about is like the relative sort of orbital, the rotation rate versus like the orbital velocity of the black hole, kind of? I don't know. Does that make sense?
So over here we are only considering our relative velocity of our orbiting object, which is like relative to the gas which is actually flowing past it. So if we add on another velocity which is due to rotation of the envelope, then that's going to kind of affect how all these gas flows kind of go around and how like how our flow morphology is going to actually change. So it's not going to so I have actually not repeated all my numerical experiments with a rotating envelope, and so I can't exactly say like how our gas flow morphology would actually change, but it would have some effect on our gas flow morphology, and it would like affect the amount of material or the rate of material which is being accreted and our drag forces, etc.
Okay, I guess because the orbital velocity of the black hole, like that depends on the radius, and that also could change things, I guess. Is that maybe the reason? Because it's not just the relative motion of the black hole and the star and the surrounding medium, right? Because there are other factors at play.
There are other factors that determine like how much material or at like one point the envelope would be ejected and how much material would be actually ejected at the end of the phase or at the beginning of the phase, and it can also actually set at what point our common envelope interaction would actually start. So all these factors are actually also dependent on our core rotation, but as a start in our numerical experiments, like we saw, like what the outcomes would be if we consider the easiest case of the envelope not rotating. So I think that it would be like interesting for sure to actually see what and how our gas flows and our accretion and our drag force actually would change, and what the original physics are that we actually would be able to incorporate if we include the effect of a rotating envelope, as you said.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, last question from Juan.
Sorry, I did not have a question. I just forgot to lower my hand.
Okay. Well, if there are no more questions, thank you again, Sumi, for the nice talk.
Thank you very much.